Okay, the next conference speaker is Joanne Bourget. We're very happy to have her with us today. She's a nurse from Nunavik. She's also worked as a nurse in Gaza. And before starting, I'd like to realize a little dream or make a dream come true that might be a little bizarre. I'd like to ask everybody to get up, stand up, and to take 1 minute of silence. I'll tell you why. Because when I think of 1 million young Palestinians, just a minute, I'm going to explain the reason before, because you want to know. There's been over 1,000 young Palestinian children between 9 years, 13 years, up to like 19, 20, who have been killed for the most part after having thrown rocks at soldiers or at tanks. And these young people that we present often as terrorists or as violent children, those children have died because they resisted to the violence. There's not a lot of people. I haven't heard many people crying for them. And I promise that the people, I would ask people to at least to remember them, and in their memory, to think about them, and for them, and as well now, the same thing for the Inuit in a little village in Via Kurovik. And there are about 450 inhabitants in 2000 and 2001. There were over 10 kids who killed themselves. And when I asked why, they said because these children don't know how to adjust themselves to civilization, and that's how we explain it. That's how we explain the colonization in the Great North and the death of those young people. And I want the deaths of those young people and those children, and I don't want that to be in vain. And I want us to remember them as resistors and as beautiful. Thank you. So, it was important for me and for them as well. I've spoken a few before about the situation in Palestine. It's for certain people, it may be repetitive. Well, when I decided to go to Palestine, in the occupied territories, it was with a very precise idea not to get there as a colonized, as a settler, as with the attitude a bit like the colonizing attitude that when we arrive in countries that we call underdeveloped or countries that are at war, or what that meant is that I didn't want to get there with a project already established ahead of time. I had an expertise that was as a nurse in trauma and emergency, and I wanted to go there and give and share my expertise and discuss with them the needs on the ground, and that's what I did. I left on my own means. And I presented myself over there for the first time. It's not very easy to present yourself in Palestine, because first you arrive in Israel, and then you enter in the occupied territories. And as I've told the story many times up till now, I just want to establish a link to show two very different situations of life for children who live in Israel and for the children who live in Palestine. I've spoken often about the film called Promises, because I've said it in English. It's a very beautiful film that was made by an American Jew on the situation. In fact, it's to show the closeness between the links between a group of Palestinian children in Daisha in Bethlehem and a group of Jewish children. And the children are about 13. They had to present themselves. In particular, the Israeli children had to go to Daisha to meet other people about their age. One of the young Israelis, a beautiful young boy of 13, when he presented himself before Kifa, who's a young Palestinian from Daisha, he said they told each other their situation and they played together. They shared their life. And the little Israeli said, "I understand. I understand what the Palestinians are doing. I understand the resistance. To see how they live, I could never live like that." So a few months later, the producer of the film, the Jewish American, returned to speak to the young people that he had met to make the film, while they were shooting the film. He wanted to see if the friendship had stayed between those young people, and he met the young Israeli, and the young Israeli said to him, "You see, well, I can't be implicated anymore because I'm now, my priority is my studies and my sports." Is those the things that all the mothers in the world would love for their kids to have as priorities? And then he tried to interview Kifa from Daisha near the refugee camp, and Kifa had been killed while throwing rocks at the entry of the checkpoint in Bethlehem. And those are the two realities that are completely different, the two worlds that are completely different on a small territory. The situation of the Palestinian people is a people who live in a territory, of millions of people, 23% of the population of the territory of Israel. What remains to them is 23% of the territory of Israel, and that's where we find the refugee camps. Inside that 23%, there are colonies, Israeli colonies. Those colonies are situated in general in very strategic places, in general on hills. They overlook the towns or the refugee camps and the cities, the Palestinian cities, and they overlook the secondary roads that the Palestinians take and that we as ambulance drivers take to go and get the patients and the sick and the injured. And naturally they're armed. And every village inside the West Bank is, and every city inside the Gaza Strip are encircled by the army. In Gaza, it's even more closed. Gaza is a territory, you can imagine a territory that's 15 kilometers by 4 kilometers wide, where there are millions of Palestinians who live, surrounded by a wall of cement and barbed wire, and a colony on Israeli colony on the edge of the sea. And they're very rich and they're armed. We were talking about terror earlier, the terror that one of the orators lived, like the people who were supposed to speak today lived. The majority of Palestinians in the occupied territories, and what I lived as well over there, is the terror day after day. The terror did not start after the 11th of September. The terror has existed for years at different degrees and at different moments in time. I arrived in Palestine before the 11th of September. on it's sure that things have expected to have gotten worse since the 11th of September, but before the 11th of September, we were bombing the occupied territories. They were bombing Gaza. Can you imagine an F-16 bomb on a territory 15 by 4 kilometers? It's not far from where you live. They were bombing, and all the houses, every refugee camp, and at the end of every street of every refugee camp, there are four big cities in Gaza. There's Rafah, which is on the edge beside Egypt. Then you have Deir el-Bala, Gaza City, Khan Yunis. In every one of those places, there's a refugee camp, a Palestinian refugee camp, and they're squeezed together like animals, like beasts. And they're watched by Israel. That means that at night, the water and electricity is cut, and when they live in cabins, they leave in the streets. They're not even streets. They're little tiny streets, and they sit there in the evenings and to spend the night sitting on the floor, on the ground. The water is controlled. They have the right in Gaza. They have the right to the water that's already been used by Israel. In other words, it's water that, if they have the capacity, they recycle themselves after it's already been used by Israel or by the colonies. That's how they live. And more so when we talk about the terror, at the end of each little street, the houses are constantly chilling. There are radars, or there are soldiers, Israeli soldiers who are situated on elevated areas that shoot at the walls, and they shoot at the walls of the houses on anything that moves. And we went and looked for kids at one point, like little 16, 17 year old young people who were going out to get to see a friend, and when they go out, they get shot because officially there's no curfew, but everything that goes out, everybody who goes outside when it's dark is considered a terrorist. Anyone, and yet they go outside, they leave their outside of their houses. It's up to them to save themselves from this space. Nobody can go and get those people.
Because to go there and take them, you have to risk your own life. And when they're demolishing houses, they're starting with shooting the people. Well, the shooting houses, you can find, you know, the houses with a lot of holes of bullets. And once the people left from the house or went out or flew, they're bombing the houses. And then they say there are no more houses. And they go with the bulldozers and they take what's left. So it becomes a territory that is not even useful to live, and it's considered as virgin land. So when you're living in that context, you're living terror, and it's everywhere. Even for an ambulance, when we were going in the West Bank is a territory. When we're talking of occupied territories, we have Gaza and what we call in English West Bank, and then in the northern area, northeast of Israel, it's the same distance, the distance between West Bank and Gaza, it's like from Montreal to Drummondville, more or less. So to go from one area to another, well, no Palestinian can leave from Gaza, so it's impossible for any of them to leave and go to the West Bank. So there's no communication between Palestinian people of those areas. Then for West Bank, it's impossible to leave many houses many towns, because there are so many checkpoints that it's totally controlled. And that was even before, way before September the 11th. The army, when it withdrew in 97 from a few towns, they just went outside of the limit of the town. So they're just right close to the main streets. When I'm talking of the army, I mean tanks and everything, the soldiers, and there are the F-16 as well. visiting the area for intimidation, and you never know when they're going to bomb the people there. So when you go in the area of the West Bank, any thing you have to do, whether you have to take your papers, maybe if you want to change university, because they can cross from one, they can go from one city to another, anything you want to do becomes risky. I had a friend, and his dad was wounded. He was well, for some reason he was wounded, and the boy couldn't even see his father because he didn't have any papers, so he couldn't go from one city to another, because in Palestine the papers are released by Israel, so they're the ones who decide who will get those papers. And if you studied abroad as Palestinian and you want to go back to your own land, even though your family is there, it's not that easy to get your papers back and your ID, because probably for them it would have been better that you stay outside, so that you just, you know, lose your Palestinian identity. So that's the reality. That's the life of any Palestinian. That's the way it goes. But even though we know that, we're talking of Palestinian terrorists. So if we're saying that there are terrorists in Palestine, I can almost swear that each Palestinian, since he's born until his grandmother or grandfather, are potential terrorists, because each Palestinian, since 87, since the beginning of Intifada, each Palestinian decided, in one way or another, each of them decided to resist. And the whole story of, since 1948, the Palestinian people was displaced many times from refugee camp to another. And you can even find them in the south of Lebanon, in Jordan, in Syria, all over, in all those areas where the poverty is even worse than it is in the occupied territories. And even within the occupied territories, many of them had to leave from other refugee camps before that. I met with people who went away from Sabra Shatila in south of Lebanon, so most of Lebanese had to leave from several, or at least one or two refugees camp before getting there. So since 87, now we see that there's no way to leave or to move from there. The terror doesn't scare them anymore, because there's nothing else left, because what they have in front of them is even worse than terror. They thought one day they will have their land, one day they would go back to their land. Now they don't believe in that anymore, so they're not going to move anymore. Even from the refugees camp, they're not going to leave. So that is the type of resistance that we're seeing today, and that is what Israel and United States can't conceive now, that they never thought before that the people, the population, since the beginning of Intifada in 87, they never thought that they would decide not to leave. Most of Palestinians would tell you, okay, just kill us all, we will always make sure that there's one Palestinian left, and he will be there to claim his own land. And each Palestinian is resisting in its own way. Whether we accuse them, whether they're accused to be terrorists or accused to accused of willing to scare other people or terrorize other people, they don't care, because they didn't get anything from the negotiations. There was nothing stopped there. The settling kept on going. the massacres were still ongoing. I thought of the Jenin massacre when I was there. In November, there was a massacre in Bethlehem, in Batrima as well, close to Bethlehem. Very bad massacres, almost important or bad as Sabra Shatila. What happened in Jenin was as important as what happened in Sabra Shatila. So nothing, no inquiry was done. And the United Nations didn't even have the guts to go there, to go there on the field in Jenin to find out what happened. But Kofi Annan should have experience. He's a black person. He should know what they're talking about. He shouldn't ask his own boss to if he has the right to go there. They didn't ask the Afrikaners to make an inquiry and find out all the crimes that were perpetrated there. So it's the same thing for Israel. You don't ask the United States to go there and to make an inquiry. And that inquiry didn't even happen. It didn't even go there on the field to see what happened. We're just waiting for things to be forgotten. I saw once a theater play that was performed by kids, and it was presenting Palestinian parents who were encouraging their kids to go there and get killed or die for the Palestinian cause. So if we remember history of the native people that were presented as stupid people when they were going to war or they were massacred, they were considered as people who would kill anybody without discrimination, savages. So when we're thinking of the history of black people who were rebellious and they were presented as violent people or even considered with less intelligence. So each time people resist to authorities that are that important and countries that are so rich and colonizers, whether it's Israel, United States, Canada, France, or England, each time, all over the world, those people who are resisting are presented like stupid people, like people who don't know how to care about their kids, like people who don't care to send their kids and to get killed. But I know in Palestine, I've seen mothers with their phone, they were calling their kids anytime to make sure that the kids were okay when they were going to take their papers for the university or they were visiting their father or brother who were at the hospital. I saw so many people calling all the time on their cell phones to make sure that everything was fine, that their relatives were doing fine. But when right outside of your own home, you see tanks and soldiers, and you go out and you see there are bullet holes in the houses of your neighbors, you don't need people to tell you that violence, well, you know, your violence, you have it there, you see it on a daily basis. So those kids were born with that. And they develop mechanisms to resist to that, and they don't want to be intimidated. They see the tanks and they wave their flags, Palestinian flags, and they throw rocks. That's true. And I saw them. I saw that there were raiders, and they were, you know, that they shoot if they see anybody passing on a certain area, you know, the radar will identify you and then and they will shoot at you. And you know, the kids were trying to throw rocks to those radars to make them fall.
I even saw tanks of the United Nations, brought by the United Nations. The United Nations were no longer there, but tanks brought that people built on that people had built up onto rocks, and over their heads there were tanks, and they installed that they would put their houses. Oh, tents! Sorry, not tanks. Tents that they would build up. Is that this was a way of saying that they wouldn't leave. And when we live in situations like that, when we live in that way, there comes a point when we've discovered that the only thing that's left is resistance. It's the only way to keep our dignity. And we don't wait for the world to tell us. That's all that's left. There's no past, there's no present, there's no future. They need to create it themselves. And they resist to have a future. Thank you.